So, how long we got? Where's our destination today?
I don't know. We got 20 miles to cover. Let's talk some movies. People don't know how to drive.
Are we going to get lunch on this gig? You see anything good recently?
Not really. We got a little time, Steve. Let's do a podcast.
Sounds good.
We're back with Film Driven. I'm Andre Shane.
Hi, I'm Steve Haskett.
And as always, we're driving through the, you know, not for very long, but still sunny streets of Chicago and talking about movies, Steve. So today's topic is...
Well, it's another edition of Cinematic Smackdown.
Oh, yes. The Battle of the Andersons. We got Paul Thomas Anderson in the red corner. And
I guess Wes in the... In the blue?
That's right, that's right. If we're going to use the boxing metaphors, I don't know who'd actually win in a boxing match between those two, but probably go with Paul Thomas.
Probably Paul, yeah.
I don't know, man. Maybe that's unfair. Maybe Wes would actually kick his butt fairly decisively.
It's a tall, scrawny guy. Sometimes
who knows?
Those guys are tough.
Well, yeah, you just never know. It's just I think that Wes would probably mess up his ascot.
That's true.
That's where I'm heading with that. But regardless, two fine filmmakers, and they have quite a bit in common, right, Steve?
They sure do. Beyond just their last names, both of these guys are, they're almost exactly the same age. I think Wes is maybe 1 year older. In a weird biographical coincidence, I think they're the exact same height.
Ah, there you go.
Both of them had shorts that played at Sundance.
Short
before
film,
their features.
Clothing.
Correct. A short film that got them some attention and some funding to make their first feature.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them, their first features were released in 1996. Paul Thomas Anderson with Hard Eight and Wes with Bottle Rocket.
That's right. Two excellent films and actually amongst their best. And, you know, we've been talking for some time about doing a podcast about these two specific filmmakers, not just because they are... Well, they have the same last name, but also because they're both kind of quirky in their own way, and they kind of operate outside of the Hollywood mainstream in a way. I mean, you both Paul Thomas Anderson and Wes Anderson make kind of unique films and films that are not for everybody. Decidedly have a specific audience they're trying to nail here. I'm not sure what the audience is, but it's definitely not mainstream. I mean, these guys have always been a little bit off the beaten path, and sometimes way off the beaten path.
Yeah, they both do their thing. And another similarity between the two of them, both of them came to kind of larger prominence with their second movies. First movies were not widely seen, even amongst filmgoers.
Right.
With their second movie, they got a lot more prominence. Again, similar time, and they kind of came up with this crop of filmmakers like Sam Mendes and Spike Jones and Christopher Nolan, all these guys who came out kind of hard-hitting films in the late 90s, the end of the 20th century, and maybe Fincher as well, where we all thought, like, wow, this is the next group of great filmmakers.
Right, right. And then, I mean, Fincher was slightly earlier than that. I mean, it certainly started in the late 80s,
really. He was the Coppola of the group.
He was. He was sort of, he did kind of start that whole movement. But, I mean, they definitely were part of that sort of 90s indie cinema revival that was, you know, that's certainly long behind us now. But was certainly exciting at the time. And both of these guys were right at the cutting edge making... Again, unique, kind of quirky films. And what do you think of Bottle Rocket?
Bottle Rocket, to me, it's very much a first film. I did not see it until after I had seen several of Wes's other movies. It follows the classic first film thing where it's about a low-level crime. So many directors' first movies
right.
are like, it's going to be about just a real, a simple crime. And in this case, it's a heist film.
Right.
You see a lot of the Wes Anderson familiar touches
yes.
in an early form.
And familiar faces.
He didn't quite have the budget for it. But what it did have, it has the charm of Wes Anderson movies are in there. Like, unusual rhythms.
Right.
To some of the dialogue. And mm-hmm. and there's a level of humor there that's just a little quirky, which I like. It's also the first movie, I think, ever, first appearance of Wes Anderson's college roommate, Owen Wilson.
That's right.
Who co-wrote Bottle Rocket.
Right, right. Owen Wilson was a constant collaborator of Wes Anderson, of course, and you know, we kind of forget that Owen Wilson was a writer. You know, he's not just an actor, and acting was almost a sideline for him, it seems like, you know. So that's... I kind of hope he goes back to that a little bit.
Because I don't think he's left the world of writing. I don't think he's gone from it forever.
Yeah, I hope not. Because he was really good. And besides being a good actor and having a good screen persona, I mean, the guy has a good ear for dialogue and, you know, and is a solid writer. I'd really like to see more of that from him.
Yeah, a difference between the two directors is all of Wes Anderson's movies are co-written. And the first three were all co-written with Owen Wilson.
That's right.
Who, as I mentioned, they met in college. Wes was a philosophy major, and they started making movies together. And both Owen and his brother Luke appear in Bottle Rocket.
Right, right, of course.
And I like Owen Wilson in general, and Owen Wilson's great, I think, in Bottle Rocket. I
mean, he is.
The
and
kind
so
of
is
Owen
Luke.
Wilson on-screen persona is established right away. Right. You know, my favorite line of the whole movie is, the heist totally goes awry. They do not succeed in their quest. Mm-hmm. Owen Wilson's character gets thrown in jail. And at the end of the movie, when they're visiting him, he just looks around his friends and goes, "Guys, we really did it." And, they did not.
Yeah. Well, they didn't succeed. They gave it a good college try, as it were.
They committed a crime, I guess.
Yeah, they did. They did commit a crime. And it's funny, though, because it's like, you know, Bottle Rocket, Wes's first film, and Paul's first film, The Hard Eight, both are very similar thematically in a sense that they both kind of deal with a younger criminal being mentored by an older criminal.
That's
in the case
correct.
Of Bottle Rocket, the older criminal is James Caan. In the case of The Hard Eight, it's Philip Baker Hall. Another weird, like, similarity between them two is that their first films have an enormous amount in common. I gotta say that after that, the commonality kind of ends there.
That's true. It splits out after that.
They split off very, very pronouncedly after that. Well, what do you think of A Hard Eight?
It was not the first Paul Thomas Anderson movie I saw. Mm-hmm. So then watching it retrospectively, you can see some of his familiar themes and traits all there in like an early form,
right.
Like not quite as refined.
Right.
But it's a great, you know, little character piece.
It is.
And the three, I guess there's kind of four main characters
right,
in there.
Right, right.
And they're all pretty well defined, and it just works. It's a great little film.
Right. Well, I think, you know, if you compare it to Bottle Rocket is a lot more kind of shambling and loose, you know, whereas A Hard Eight is very, very... It's very compact. It's very economical in the storytelling. It seems like a film by a more mature filmmaker right off the bat than Bottle Rocket is. Even though the themes are similar, but the movie's a lot tighter. It's a lot more calculated. It's a lot more controlled, and it just feels like a more. It seems kind of more budget, even more high budget, even though. It really takes place in a couple of rooms,
yeah,
essentially.
Yeah, it sounds like a filmed play.
Yeah, it really is, but I don't know why it just feels that way to me. It feels like a bigger movie than Bottle Rocket somehow, whereas Bottle Rocket feels like a movie by a very young man. I feel like A Hard Eight could have been made by an old guy, you know, like a Sidney Lumet almost kind of a vibe.
Yeah, the interesting thing about... Hard Eight is the protagonist, like the main character of Hard Eight, is the older criminal.
Sure, of course,
you know?
It is Philip Baker.
In Bottle Rocket, it's very clearly from the perspective of the younger one.
Exactly.
But Hard Eight, like, it's an interesting movie for a 25, 26-year-old filmmaker to make. Right. Because the whole movie is basically about a middle-aged man looking right. back on his life and the things he regrets.
Right. And I find that to be sort of a recurring thing in P.T. Anderson's career. He seems to, a lot of times, have an amazing amount of feeling for these guys that are way older than him and has really understands kind of the psyche of an older guy to some extent more than he seems to understand the psyche of a younger guy. His younger characters almost tend to be kind of goofy and immature, whereas his older characters seem to be kind of like he gets them better somehow. Yeah. You know, I don't know if you notice that in other movies, but I think he really identifies with these older seasoned guys much more than he does with these young punks. You know, whereas
yeah, the point of view of his movie isn't I'm the young upstart who's the old people don't know anything and the young people know. It's more that no, actually the older guys do kind of know things and the younger guys are they're a little dumb about the world.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and Wes Anderson, on the flip side of the coin, as his career progresses, seems to be even more in identification with younger and younger characters. He's a guy who really kind of, I think he views himself as just a very large child.
You know? Could be argued, yeah.
Because, like, his protagonists are so often these kind of young, very young, but very brilliant guys who just are kind of trying to shape the world to their own concept of what the world should be. And that's really best exemplified by Wes Anderson's next film, Rushmore, you know, which is kind of the quintessential Wes Anderson movie.
It really is, yeah.
Yeah, where Rushmore, you have it's essentially a duel between a young genius and an older genius. They're both kind of flip sides of the same coin. You know, they have same obsessions. They're in love with the same woman. And the young guy is played by a constant collaborator of Wes Anderson, Jason Schwartzman, who actually ends up writing some of the later
Wes
Anderson
films. Yeah, Rushmore, it might have been Jason Schwartzman's first film.
I mean, he had kind of a persona established from the word go, and one wonders to what extent that was his persona, whether he just kind of fitted to the Wes Anderson persona. But, you know, that whole alchemy between those two just worked out great in that film. And,
yeah.
And the film is just very, it's entertaining, it works, it's weird, it's... It really, again, it's just the ultimate Wes Anderson movie. If you want to see just one, that's the one to see if you haven't seen it already.
I agree. I think Rushmore is probably still his best movie. You know, at the time it came out, it felt very exciting. It, Wes Anderson, with that, seemed to establish himself as kind of the new Hal Ashby of cinema, if not the Coen brothers.
But there's a little of that, yes.
Rushmore, to me, felt very akin in tone to Harold and Maude, if nothing else.
That's right. I think I think that's a huge influence on him, particularly that film. Hal Ashby, you know, Hal Ashby was much more diverse in his themes,
sure.
You know, but Harold and Maude was definitely, you know, maybe the ultimate Hal Ashby movie, and...
But yeah, everything, all the things love or hate about Wes Anderson is in Rushmore in a great way. I mean, the foregrounding of little objects and minutiae to describe the character,
yeah.
the quick montages with jump cuts about the activities.
Right.
The great dialogue, the kind of deadpan delivery.
Uh-huh.
Also,
the
very
quirky
famously,
soundtrack.
Both these directors work with... You know, the same actors over and over again. Mm-hmm. Like Hard Eight, Philip Baker Hall also appeared in Magnolia, and then, of course, John C. Reilly's in several Paul Thomas Anderson films.
Of course.
Oh, and Philip Seymour Hoffman, of course, has a small role in Hard Eight, and he comes back in almost all of, one of Paul Thomas Anderson's movies. Rushmore is Wes Anderson's first collaboration with Bill Murray, who then is in literally every Wes Anderson movie from that point on.
Right.
It's also, Rushmore was the first, there were a couple forays into dramatic territory before this, but, you know, these days everybody knows Bill Murray is the kind of funny yet soulful, melancholic actor.
Right.
And Rushmore is the movie that established that Bill Murray persona.
Right, absolutely. I mean, Rushmore sort of showed that Bill Murray, even in a comedy, could be kind of a heartbreaker from an audience perspective. He's tried that before, man. He did, remember, he had this attempt to become a serious actor. He did a version of The Razor's Edge, which was not real good, in my opinion, and not as good as the old version, the old Hollywood version of The Razor's Edge. So he kind of failed that way, but then he came at it from another perspective, came at it from a more comedic perspective, and now, of course, you know, it's the Bill Murray we know and love, you know, Bill Murray who can do just about anything.
Yeah, and Wes Anderson, interestingly, you know, they don't go into a lot about it, but seemingly the only director in the world who Bill Murray can tolerate for more than one or two movies.
Yeah, they love,
I mean, at this point, they've had a relationship that's going into its second decade.
Yeah.
And all comments in the press are that they get along just fine.
Yeah, it's good to see. And the second P.T. Anderson film, of course, was just a giant hit for him. You know, Rushmore was a... It's kind of a beloved film.
Yeah,
it was
a
modest hit. It's a low-budget movie. But P.T.'s next film, of course, Boogie Nights, was a huge hit and, you know, is arguably one of the best films of the 90s. Certainly a classic beyond what Rushmore is. And really, I mean, it's hard to argue that it is a great film. I mean, for my money, it's probably the best P.T. Anderson film, certainly my favorite, and just an amazingly mature piece of work. Again, you know, Heart 8 was pretty mature, but this one was just, I mean, granted, you have to sort of give it, you know, or rather subtract some points for being really, really a heavy homage to Martin Scorsese's work.
Huge, huge.
But nonetheless, you know, it just all works remarkably well in the Boogie Nights. I mean, Boogie Nights is incredibly watchable. It works on a bunch of different levels. It's funny when it needs to be funny. It's, you know, sad when it needs to be sad. It's got tons of quotable dialogue. It's got great characters. It's just a terrific movie.
It's more or less a Scorsese movie. And now that sounds like a huge knock. The two things that are positive about that statement is, one, it's not a subject Scorsese had ever made a movie about before.
Right.
Like, you know, it's
or
not like...
would.
Well, yeah, so Paul Thomas Anderson didn't make a mob movie and rip off Scorsese style.
Right.
Because then you'd be like, all right, you know, I've seen this.
Right.
This felt like if you hired Martin Scorsese to direct this movie about the 70s porn industry. And so therefore, you know, so you've never seen this movie before. And then if you're going to do a competent ripoff, I mean, you could do worse than doing a competent ripoff of one of the greatest directors of all time.
Absolutely. I mean, and of course, you could make a case, and we talked about it when we discussed Scorsese's work, and Scorsese was heavily, heavily borrowing from a bunch of filmmakers across the ages. So I'm sure Scorsese doesn't mind the fact that Boogie Nights is heavily influenced by his work, which was in turn heavily influenced by other artists, and in some cases... could be said to be a little bit of a ripoff of some other directors.
Sure, but everybody, you know, there's an argument to be made that, you know, throughout the course of cinematic history, different directors will invent different techniques, different styles. So then when new directors come around, it's less important to me that they create some entirely original cinematic language than that they just know when to correctly apply these styles and tools that the people before you have established.
Yeah.
So Boogie Nights has been justly called a bit, you know, heavily in debt to Scorsese, but the things it's in debt to are not anything you complain about as a movie watcher. You're not like, wow, I really hated that exciting tracking shot and, you know, this fast pace with great music. Wow, that really just brought me down. And that is... one of the things about Paul Thomas Anderson, for somebody who, you know, he went to NYU for 2 days and then dropped out and took his tuition money back and made his own short film. For somebody who never went to film school and, you know, kind of had to learn all the technical aspects on the fly, his movies are very cinematic in terms of, yeah. And, I mean, Wes Anderson is cinematic, too, in a different way. But Paul Thomas Anderson, especially in his early days, lots of camera movement, very comfortable with all the tools of cinema. And
And very comfortable with tone as well. I mean, this is what I want to come back to. From a director's perspective, tone, the right and consistent tone is the hardest thing to nail. Really the hardest thing, because tone is kind of instinctive. It's not based so much on camera moves or, you know, technical stuff. It's based on a completely different vibe. It's sort of a combination of all the alchemy that goes into filmmaking. It's a combination of acting, it's a combination of directing, it's a combination of cinematography, and so on and so forth, and a combination of editing, all of it put into this sort of cauldron and coming out to as a complete whole. And there, both the Anderson boys are terrific. I mean, they both kind of nail the tone that they're going after every single time. There's not a single case. Well, okay, I may be wrong. I could think of one for P.T. Anderson where I think his tone is off, where he's a little tone deaf. But we'll talk about that later when we get to it. But for the most part, and certainly in Boogie Nights, he nails it. It's just like, bam, it's a home run.
You know, Wes Anderson's movies, even the biggest Wes Anderson hit, was still kind of a little culty.
He's an independent guy.
And Paul Thomas Anderson, you know, it's interesting. As he's gone, he's gotten less mainstream recently.
Right.
But both of those guys started out, I mean, as filmmakers who their movies were kind of big hits in the kind of art house world.
Right.
But then Paul Thomas Anderson graduated into more mainstream theaters. You know, I mean, certainly... Right. Boogie Nights, Magnolia, and Punch Drunk Love were all movies that were playing at your local multiplex.
Right.
And Wes Anderson has never really made it there. I mean, if he had a, you know, Moonrise Kingdom was a big hit, so maybe expanded into, like, one screen for people who are into that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's not like opening weekend of Moonrise Kingdom, you can just go to your suburban AMC and watch his movies.
Well, Wes Anderson kind of remains in the art house.
Yeah, he never removed it. And Paul Thomas Anderson got out, and then kind of he's back.
Yeah, well, he's kind of using the more mainstream, the kind of a larger palette to tell even more quirky and out there stories, you know?
Yeah.
In a funny way, you know, even though... Wes is more of an art house guy and makes movies that are considerably more miniature. And a lot of his work has been described as kind of miniature movies in a sense, you know. Even though he's like that, in many ways his little miniatures are a lot more accessible than Paul Thomas Anderson's bigger movies, which a lot of times are kind of tough nuts to crack. The next Wes Anderson movie, I think, maybe his best. Right, Steve? That's The Royal Tenenbaums?
I would give Rushmore the slight edge. Both of these guys, with the success of Boogie Nights and Rushmore, then they got access to bigger budgets, bigger stars.
Right.
And they both took advantage of it.
They sure did.
I mean, the Royal Tenenbaums has a large cast with genuine movie stars in it.
That's right.
If for nothing else, the Royal Tenenbaums gave us presumably the last great Gene Hackman performance.
Oh, no question about it. And in fact, maybe one of his greatest performances.
Yeah.
The fact that he did not actually win an Oscar for that film, I think, is a friggin' travesty, in my opinion. Gene Hackman is genius in that film.
Yeah.
But that movie just, I just love The Royal Tenenbaums. I mean, that movie, it never gets old for me. And I think out of those two filmmakers, out of their entire body of work, for both of them, I think for me it's Boogie Nights and Royal Tenenbaums. Those are the two films that really, really stand out. And of course, they're the two films that came out roughly the same time, right? Within a couple of years of one another, right?
Yeah.
That's just a coincidence. But those are really the films that stand out. And Tenenbaums is just... Yeah, I just love it. It's hard to really nail what it's about exactly, but it's wildly entertaining, incredibly watchable, funny. I mean, genuinely funny, but also has some, you know, really really dark themes in it, and it just
sure,
works.
There's an attempted suicide. There's drug addiction.
Oh yeah, and it just works on multiple levels. It's one of those stories. It's a movie about a lot of different characters. It's not focused on, you know, one protagonist. It has many protagonists. It's an entire family of protagonists, and that's kind of unusual. It's not something that's done. It's challenging as a film, as a subject matter, and he just handles it amazingly well. It's his third feature, and again, knocks it out of the park, much like Boogie Nights for Paul Thomas.
The only knock I have against the Royal Tenenbaums and why I give Rushmore the slight edge is I feel that everything in Rushmore works. And the Royal Tenenbaums, with so many characters and so many storylines, like, there's some weak ones in there. I mean, specifically, Owen Wilson's character has a drug problem.
Right.
Which, for the first third to half of the movie, you're not entirely convinced how seriously you should take this.
Whether it's a comedy and drug problem or real.
Exactly. Yeah. And then at the end, there's a couple lines which you're supposed to accept that you should at least take it semi-seriously. Yeah. I mean, you know, you're not watching some heroin tragedy, but you're still not, right. You're not supposed to just mock his drug problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
And,
well, there's and lots that, of major and, problems and it sets
up,
in that film.
And it sets up a problem with Wes Anderson that'll come more and more. As you were saying, he can be accused of being a little bit of a child. There are times where Wes Anderson attempts to tackle grown-up problems and stumbles.
Right.
I mean, he does good about alienation and feeling unloved, but that's a child's problem as well.
Right.
But, yeah, so the whole drug aspect, Owen Wilson's character in Royal Tenenbaums just doesn't work a lot for me. Right. But there's so much good stuff, it's hard to quibble. There's a thing in the Royal Tenenbaums which I feel Wes Anderson has tried in several other movies, sometimes successful, sometimes not, where he has this comedic movie going along that you're kind of laughing, and then there's some, like, emotional gut punch moment that just pulls the rug out from under you and just hits you with, like, a lot of heart. And to me, that moment in the Royal Tenenbaums is where, towards the end, when Gene Hackman's falling down and, like, Gene Hackman and Ben Stiller's character finally have this reconciliation.
Right.
And it's acknowledged that Ben Stiller's wife's died and he felt abandoned by his dad during that time. And, you know, Ben Stiller, who, is not generally considered one of our greater dramatic actors, just kind of, like, half loses it for a moment. It's like, I've had a rough year, Dad.
Right.
And, I mean, that scene makes me cry, every time I watch it.
It's absolutely
And it's just,
powerful.
It's an amazing feat that in this movie that's kind of goofy, that you just out of nowhere have this incredibly emotional moment that
right.
then puts into sharp relief all the emotional undercurrents that were there in the rest of the film.
Yeah.
But just treated with like a comedic sheen.
Yeah.
So
I always find that comedy is a good roadway to the heart. If you really want to gut punch somebody from cinematically or dramatically, the best way to do it is to soften them up with laughter. And of course, you know, I mean, kind of Charlie Chaplin sort of invented that concept, I guess. But, you know, for Wes Anderson, his whole, like, outlook on the world is that of a child. So a lot of times when he looks at adult problems, I have a feeling he kind of scoffs at them the way your kid kind of, like, watches you balance your checkbook and kind of laughs at himself for not having to do it, and goes back to his video games. That's sort of the way he, I think, views the world. So a lot of times, these problems that we view as very serious, like, you know, like Owen Wilson's drug addiction in Royal Tenenbaums, is for most of the movie treated as a bit of a joke. You know, he's just a silly guy. He's walking around. He's putting on weird costumes. He's putting makeup on himself, acting weird. And then at the end of the, towards the end of the movie, you realize, like, hey, this guy's really screwed up. You know, this guy can die as a result of this. And It hits home pretty well, but the overall approach to it is very kind of childlike. You know, the viewpoint is always of a child. And that, of course, really, really becomes, you know, he takes it to the most extreme extent in his last film, Moonrise King,
yeah, well,
which
I
we'll
mean,
talk
the,
about.
The two most recent Wes Anderson movies are, for all intents and purposes, children's films.
Right. Right. I think he's almost committing to be a children's filmmaker at this point, you know. I mean,
we'll have to see, yeah.
Yeah, we got to see, you know, and we'll see how it works out. But, I mean, like, his movies are not necessarily for children, but they're almost like by children. It's an interesting thing. And very different from Paul Thomas, who definitely, you know, not very childlike in his perspective on characters. That's for sure, you know. So the next Paul Thomas Anderson movie, Steve, is a weird one, Magnolia. What do you think of Magnolia?
Magnolia is thoroughly enjoyable. It's one of those movies where, and this sets up to me what has become a little bit of a problem with Paul Thomas Anderson, where he's great at making movies that feel important.
Right.
And but then if you really start digging into them, you have to question
right.
how important they are. So Magnolia is a movie that at the end of it, you feel like you should have been given some sort of profound truth about life. But then if you ask me what that is, I couldn't tell you. yeah. That said, as a movie, I mean, there's so much to recommend in it. Right. It's just, like you say, in tone, it's got a great, the scene, everything's well-paced.
Right.
There's just a who's who of great performances in that movie.
Right, and it's a movie that's about different things. You know, it has these sort of different characters who are seemingly unrelated, who are somewhat, you know, vaguely interconnected. Characters know other characters. It's sort of, you know, it has kind of a Nashville vibe. Not Nashville, the TV show.
But, sure.
Robert Altman's
and Anderson's Nashville. Altman's another guy up there with Scorsese who he likes.
Exactly. He loves Altman. And you know, obviously Magnolia is an homage to Altman. It's a movie about many different people going through this crazy day. Yeah, I'm with you. It's incredibly watchable. It has great performances. It deals with some of the themes that Anderson is obsessed about. P.T. Anderson, of course. You know, particularly sort of establishing a new family unit, coming to terms with your own dysfunctional family. All of this is there. And also just people of different, from like kind of different areas, finding a common connection, which is a big theme with him, you know, with especially with a cop character and that, you know, kind of drug addicted woman that he has a relationship with in that part of the film, that kind of touches upon that. So Magnolia is not as focused as Boogie Nights, and I don't think it's as good a film as Boogie Nights, but I do love Magnolia quite a bit, especially well, frankly, Tom Cruise's performance is just outstanding, probably the best performance he's ever given.
Yeah, Tom Cruise gives a great performance that's both dramatic and entertaining.
Yes.
In a way. And it's also a delight for two regulars, John C. Reilly and Philip Seymour Hoffman in Magnolia, both give performances that not only they're good, but they both get to play really likable characters.
Right.
You know,
yes.
And, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson has maintained that he thinks Philip Seymour Hoffman's character in Magnolia is fairly close to what Mr. Hoffman's like in real life. So it's always kind of nice when you see these actors who play these heavy roles to right. get to sometimes play like likable characters.
Yeah, and just unabashedly lovable characters.
Yeah, and
with
particularly
a sense
John
of humor.
C. Reilly is arguably right. the most likable character in that entire movie. You know,
yes.
As his put upon cop who tries to
retrieve his gun.
Yes.
Yes.
And then also help out the
the drug addicted woman.
Yes.
Who also gives a great performance in that film.
Who's supposedly loosely based on Fiona Apple.
Yes, I could see that. I could totally see that, Fiona Apple.
Kind of the damaged, crazy beauty.
Right, right, exactly. Well, I mean, Fiona Apple was had a long relationship with Paul Thomas Anderson.
They did, around that time, too.
Right, right, right. So it's certainly, she certainly seems crazy, but that's... That's another story. Maybe someday he'll make a movie about that.
But, well, it's
but Magnolia is one of those weird movies. You know, it has this outrageous ending. You know, the whole movie, you know, the narrative device in the film is sort of these weather patterns, you know, and this continual
sure.
thing. You know, this weather report keeps coming up throughout the course of the film, and you're like, where the hell is this going, you know? And where it's going is at the end of the movie, it starts raining frogs.
Yes.
Okay? Now, this would be... It's pretty crazy, Steve, right? Raining frogs. I mean, I know there's been records of this happening somehow, but to use that as a device in a movie for a long sequence of frogs literally falling on people and their cars and so on and so forth, that's kind of a crazy thing, right? And the amazing thing is that Magnolia kind of pulls it out. I mean,
it does pull it off. I mean, yeah. It doesn't, you know, it's certainly odd. And I have personally watched Magnolia with people who where I knew that was coming and they didn't.
Right.
And when it happens, they're like, "Whoa,
what happened?"
But it doesn't. Nobody just bails on the film at that point.
You know? No.
And it's also it sets up something which will, you know, he goes full bore on with his next film in a way, but apart from the weather patterns, it's structured a lot around Amy Mann songs.
Right.
So music is a huge part of Magnolia, to the point where during the frog scene, there's a montage of multiple characters singing.
Right, right. There's an actual sing-along moment in the film, which is another kind of stylistic chance that Anderson takes. And you know, you got to give it to the guy. I mean, this is this was so unusual and so out there that, you know, obviously when you go that far out there, thematically, you're going to lose a good chunk of your audience.
Sure.
And real artists are not afraid of that. And Paul Thomas Anderson is certainly a real artist. And he's not afraid of losing his audience to weirdness. And I respect that.
Yeah, I mean, that you could pretty much pin it down to the moment it rains frogs.
Right.
Is cinematically the moment that Paul Thomas Anderson declared that he was going to be the type of director where he's going to follow his muse and all bets are off.
Right,
and
right.
He's not necessarily going, you know, he's not an avant-garde filmmaker per se.
Right.
But he's also not going to reel in those impulses for the sake of making, you know, a complete mainstream fare.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you're going to see films by either of these guys, you're going to see films by an auteur. You're not going to see a film that's you know, produced by a committee.
No.
You're not going to see a film that's, you know, micromanaged from a, you know, from an audience response perspective. You're seeing a film by an artist who says, this is how I want it, and like it or not, sometimes successful or not, this is how it's going to be. And that's a rare thing these days.
Well, Wes Anderson's next movie is The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, and for me, this is the worst Wes Anderson movie. I don't think it's terrible. It was the biggest budget Wes Anderson had to that point.
Right.
And there's a lot of evidence watching that movie that rather than taking the large budget and just knocking it out of the park, it seemed more like he butted up against the limits of his ability. I don't know if it's his ability or the circumstances of the shoot, what have you, but there's a bunch of things in The Life Aquatic that don't work for me.
Yeah.
There's some animated bits in that movie done by Henry Selick, who directed The Nightmare Before Christmas, mm-hmm. Coraline. I think all of that feels incredibly wedged in. I mean, the shark at the end's pretty impressive, but all the other things, it really does seem like, oh, I've got the money to do this, let's throw it in.
Mm-hmm.
and you know, there's a horrible action sequence towards the end, which, I mean, it's treated a bit as a joke.
Sure,
that Wes Anderson just pretty much throws up his hands and declares, I don't know how to direct an action sequence. I didn't really find that cute. I found that as a failing.
Right.
I mean, Quentin Tarantino didn't really know how to direct an action sequence,
yeah.
So then he studied up and learned how to do it.
Yeah.
And
you could learn.
Yeah. And so Wes Anderson, there's a gunfight which consists of you hear shooting off screen, characters run off screen with their guns, and then a few minutes later they run out of a room where the gunfight took place.
Right.
Because Wes Anderson just can't be bothered to actually, like, learn how to shoot a gun. And, I mean, I get, you can argument that, you know, the gunfight itself isn't that important, but I don't know, it felt like such a punt.
Right.
I also feel with The Life Aquatic that all the things people harp on Wes Anderson for, like being quirky by design at the expense of real feeling, and all these problems come to the fore to me in The Life Aquatic. And,
yeah.
You know, he once again went for that emotional gut punch moment at the end where they're all in the submarine seeing the shark that he tries to, like, that's supposed to be the moment of heart in the film. And it just didn't work for me. I thought the Bill Murray, Steve Zissou, unlike Royal Tenenbaum, the Gene Hackman character, I just found that character unlikable.
Yeah, he was kind of a dick without any charm,
unlike
Gene Hackman. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I don't think that Bill Murray really pulled it off. And, you know, it's funny because, again, you know, what we have with these two filmmakers is we have interesting parallel career tracks where, you know, I agree with you. The Life Aquatic is one of Wes Anderson's weakest films. And the next Paul Thomas Anderson film, Punch Drunk Love is, in my opinion, his weakest film as well. So again, they're sort of on these parallel tracks where they're, you know, arguably post success, you know, film is really stumbles.
They both make some questionable decisions.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, Wes kind of, you know, clearly sticks in the box in which he's comfortable with. You know, he does not venture a lot out of that box. And that's sort of, that's his thing, you know. Paul Thomas Anderson likes to be all over the place and likes to really play in lots of different boxes. But again, you know, in the case of Punch Drunk Love, I just thought it was a huge miss. A huge miss, and I really don't know what it was about that movie that interested him that much, because it's not very complicated. And, you know, basically it's an Adam Sandler movie where Adam Sandler's kind of volatile, violent asshole with a heart of gold character is treated a little bit more seriously than, let's say, he is in, you know, what's his golf movie?
Happy Gilmore.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's sort of like Happy Gilmore treated with a slightly more serious approach. And, I, you know, my question is, who gives a shit? I mean, like why do I need to see Adam Sandler's character treated more seriously than he is in Happy Gilmore? I mean, I'm perfectly happy with Happy Gilmore just the way it is, and not really exploring that character anymore, because that character is not all that interesting. I don't think needs to be explored that much. And I think Punch Drunk Love pretty much proved that that character is not that interesting. And I'm not sure how successful that film was financially, but
It was not.
Well, to me, it just seemed like a total waste of everybody's time. It had a lot of great talent in it, but I don't know, man. I really disliked it.
I'd like to defend that movie a little bit.
Sure.
In that, I saw that movie in the theaters and really disliked it. one of the things is, you know, I'm a big believer in how your cinematic experience can affect your perception of a film.
Right.
And I was coming back from a road trip with my wife and my sister-in-law and a friend, and I convinced them all to go see this movie, and the people with us besides my wife were not people who were very adventurous moviegoers. And, I mean, they despised it, you know, like, had a grudge against me for making them into it. So, you know, I felt bad for dragging these people into this film,
yeah.
And it had a really bad taste in my mouth. But recently, I watched that movie again for the first time in a long time, and I came to like it okay. I at least saw better about what he was doing. Now, I'm with you, it's a question of why he thought that was a movie people wanted to see. But he was doing kind of two things there. I mean, one, he was, like you say, taking the established Adam Sandler persona and like, investigating it, for lack of a better word.
Uh-huh.
You know,
but,
right. I mean, Adam Sandler often has these roles where he's pretty calm, and then out of nowhere he starts yelling
right.
for comedic effect. And Paul Thomas Anderson treats, well, what if we took that character? I mean, if you imagine in real life some guy who's calm and then all of a sudden just erupts with rage, I mean, they're kind of a psychopath.
Well, yeah, I don't have to imagine it. That's me. But at the same time, well, I don't need a movie about me.
The other thing he did was he took that and he really played with the structure of a romantic comedy. That, you know, you think about some classic romantic comedies, even something like Bringing Up Baby. And, you know, a lot of times there's a film where there's an uptight male protagonist and a more free-spirited female protagonist, and they come together, and the, you know, and they, and it just works that
right.
the woman is able to, you know, smooth out the quirks of the male to at least bring him into society more, and the male proves somewhat of a grounding force for maybe the flightier characteristics
right.
of the woman. And
it's a screwball genre.
Sure.
I mean, this is what a screwball comedy is, and this is about, like, you know, combining these disparate individuals in a romantic sense, and that's great, and it was a great aspect of, like, Magnolia, for example, you know, but as a standalone film with Adam Sandler as the central character, It was kind of long too. That was another thing. It seemed to be overbaked. It didn't have enough plot to really sustain its length. Screwball comedies tend to be funny, you know, at least the classic ones. This one wasn't funny.
Well, that's where he was tweaking it.
Yeah, I think it's a failure. I think it's hard to look at it as anything but a failure, and I think even in Paul Thomas Anderson's mind, it's a failure because, you know, it took him a while to come up with his next film, whereas Wes Anderson kind of kept throwing him out there, you know?
See, I guess I just don't know if I agree with that. I feel that Punch Drunk Love, watching it again, I'm not sure if he thinks it's a failure. I kind of feel like it did what it wanted to.
Right.
I just don't know if anybody else is interested in
liked
that.
It. Yeah. Well, it may be that. And maybe it accomplished exactly what he was trying to accomplish with it, even though, I disrespect.
Apart from getting people to watch it.
To me, it's the weakest film of his entire filmography. And I don't, you know, and even if I grow to like it a little more on subsequent viewings, I don't think I can ever like it enough where it would not be the weakest film in his filmography, unless, of course, he comes out with another film that's weaker, which might happen.
Sure. Around 2002, 2003, we get this divergence in the productivity of our two guys, where Wes Anderson cranks out a new movie every 2 or 3 years, and Paul Anderson seems to... He's in this thing now where he, you know, he has other stuff going on. He has started having children. He did a little stint behind the scenes at Saturday Night Live, but now it seems like Paul Thomas Anderson's become a filmmaker that has to retreat into his cave
yes.
with his own brood
yeah.
for a good 5 years to kind of simmer in something and then emerge with the new project.
Right.
Whereas Wes Anderson, and this has good and bad results, but one of the things I kind of like about him, and this goes to his co-writing his movies, is, you know, all Wes Anderson movies have similar themes. They very much seem, you know, they obviously share a director.
Uh-huh.
But Wes Anderson seems to very much get into the idea of, he has some people he likes to work with, and he's like, hey, let's write a movie together.
Right.
And sometimes he engages people who he didn't know that well, or even people who hadn't written a movie before. I mean, The Life Aquatic was co-written with Noah Baumbach. Who, you know, he's directed The Squid and the Whale and Margot at the Wedding and Greenberg. But, you know, Noah Baumbach had a movie in the mid-90s called Kicking and Screaming and then didn't really have a lot going on. And Wes Anderson kind of pulled him out of his funk to collaborate on this Life Aquatic movie. And that, you know, according to Noah Baumbach, is what kind of got him back in the game.
Yeah, well, and that's great. Maybe that's the best thing that came out of A Life Aquatic, frankly. But
yeah, well, and then so his next movie, The Darjeeling Limited, was co-written with Roman Coppola, another part of the Coppola clan,
right,
and
right.
Jason Schwartzman.
That's right, the cousins.
Who previously had never written a screenplay, but Wes is like, hey, let's, I want to, came out of his desire to, he was watching a bunch of Satyajit Ray films, the classic Indian director. He's like, I want to go make a movie in India. So those
yeah.
three guys,
and he did,
took a month-long trip in India together and came up with a movie.
Yeah, and Darjeeling Limited is all right. It's an enjoyable film. Again, you know, again we have Wes Anderson definitely sort of saying, okay, I'm making a Wes Anderson movie, and I it's not like I expect Wes Anderson to suddenly start making Hitchcock movies or P.T. Anderson movies, but definitely you get a same vibe from all of his films at this point. And if you don't like this vibe, then you're never going to watch any Wes Anderson movies. But if you do like his vibe, then virtually anything he puts out will be quite enjoyable to you. And I personally like his vibe. So I tend to not judge his movies very harshly. I mean, if some of them, I'd like to see another great film a la The Royal Tenenbaums, but so far I haven't seen that from him. Darjeeling Limited certainly wasn't it, and neither were the ones that followed it.
I'm a little bit alone, not just in this car, but in, in the world. I love the Darjeeling Limited. My argument for that is twofold. One, more than almost any other movie, that to me feels like it's the Wes Anderson movie for adults. Children aren't really a part of that
right.
movie. That movie, it you know, it's got its quirky rhythms, but that movie is about adults. Mm-hmm. It has adult characters. It also, especially with the Jason Schwartzman character, and then there was a short that preceded it with
right.
him and Natalie Portman. But uh-huh. that carries over into the film, too, that The Darjeeling Limit is really the first Wes Anderson movie with the appearance of sex.
Right.
I mean, characters have sex in that movie
yes.
in a non-ridiculous fashion. Uh-huh.
Right.
You know, I mean, obviously there are characters in Rushmore and the Royal Tenenbaums who had sex, but it was treated the way that, like, a 12-year-old might write a sex scene.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know,
right,
like,
right, right.
Those people went in the hotel room, and I heard they did it.
Right.
And whereas The Darjeeling Limited, it seems like they're adult people who have sexual relations with other adults.
Right.
In a, you know, in a believable fashion.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. I also like that it felt, to me, it was a successful transportation of the Wes Anderson style to a whole different world.
Right.
And I felt like it worked. Like, it wasn't just, that movie couldn't have taken place anywhere. It took place in India.
Right.
I thought it walked the perfect tone of, you know, your protagonists are still your protagonists, but they're also kind of mocked.
Right.
You know, like, they're there in India hoping to have this, you know, wow, isn't this going to be an exotic experience?
Right.
And then the locals in India were like, well, to us, this isn't that exotic. You know,
right.
like, this is our life, this is our home, and I know you wacky rich white people are coming over looking to, you know, expand your souls or whatever the hell you think you're
expand
doing.
Expand your consciousness.
But we're just trying to live.
Right.
And so that, and I, you know, for me personally, too, I saw that movie when I was expecting, you know, my son to be born, so I just really identified with
yeah.
the Adrian Brody character, and I don't know, to me that...
It hit you at the right time
yeah.
with the right thing, and I like it as well, Steve.
Yeah.
I do like it. Again, you know, like, for me, like I said, I kind of measure all of Wes Anderson's films against Royal Tenenbaums. Maybe that's not that fair, because that's
yeah.
a movie that kind of hit a note with me. But again, I tend to like all of his
yeah.
movies. I just, you know, I just don't see the genius in most of them. You know, I see a guy who's kind of running laps within what he's comfortable with, and tonally, he's almost always the same. His tone,
I guess it's true that
same.
it's not a radical departure, but it
but
like I personally think the Darjeeling Limited is second or third best film, and
yeah,
unlike
be.
The Life Aquatic, it's just one of those. As you say, it's still a Wes Anderson film, mm-hmm. but in The Life Aquatic, I felt he was off his game.
Right.
And with this one, I felt he was on it.
Right, right. Well, I cannot argue with that, Steve. I think Darjeeling Limited is solid and also visually beautiful.
Oh,
I think
yeah.
that's very
Looks
important
great.
To under,
yeah.
underscore how attractive Wes Anderson's films are visually. Like how good of a visual director he is. I mean, outside of that crappy action scene in Life Aquatic, I mean, he really has a sense for what looks good, what was right. He's very fussy about the details and the minutiae of his films, but in the best possible way for a director.
Oh, yeah. No, he's very much, he's cinematic in a very different way from Paul.
Yes, yes. And, you know, which brings me to sort of the opposite side of the coin with Paul Thomas Anderson's next film, of course, the gargantuan There Will Be Blood.
Yes.
Which is, you know, as big and expansive as Darjeeling Limited is, you know, kind of small and personal. Well, what's your take on There Will Be Blood?
I like it. I think it's good. I disagree with the perception that There Will Be Blood is a masterpiece. The biggest problem for me with There Will Be Blood is that I think he let Daniel Day-Lewis's performance overwhelm the rest of the movie. And I can understand it a little bit. And Daniel Day-Lewis is one of my favorite living actors. And I, you know, if you told me there's a movie that Daniel Day-Lewis just puts around his apartment building and looks at shit, I'd probably go watch
movie.
It. Yeah, I do. I could stare at him doing things. I mean, I saw this shitty movie his wife directed where he plays kind of an incestual father. And I mean, that's a horrible movie, but, you know, it does feature 2 hours of Daniel Day-Lewis.
Daniel Day-Lewis.
And so There Will Be Blood, if you love Daniel Day-Lewis, there's a lot of Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood.
Indeed.
But the movie is set up as if what you're supposed to take away from it is, like, the great theme of the movie is religion versus commerce. And almost that the, you know, it's this war between Daniel Day-Lewis's character, Daniel Plainview, the oil prospector, and Paul Dano's character, this priest. Like, those are two equal sides at war.
Right.
And in both performance and editing, I mean, it's a one-sided fight.
Yeah, I mean, I was very, very critical of There Will Be Blood. I remember, I mean, to me, there's really nothing worse than disappointment, in a sense, you know, because it's like, for me, There Will Be Blood had one of the greatest first hours I have ever experienced at the movies, ever. And the second hour something of that film was such a massive letdown intellectually and cinematically that it's just hard for me to not look at that film as just a failure. And, you know, it's funny with that film because it got such incredible accolades when it came out critically. I mean, people touted it as the greatest American film since Citizen Kane, and it was great, and it was this, and it was that. And then, you know, the Oscars came along, and the dust settled a little bit, and they lost to No Country for Old Men, which is unquestionably a better film than There Will Be Blood, because unlike There Will Be Blood, No Country for Old Men is consistent with its tone, its message, and its sort of intellectual perspective, whereas There Will Be Blood just falls apart. He runs out of things to say in that film, and by the last 20 minutes, this is just nonsense. I mean, he's not only running laps thematically, he's literally undermining the entire foundation of the whole film. It's a massive letdown for me, and all due to basically the last half hour of the film. That if he ended that film half an hour earlier, after Daniel's character essentially murders his own brother, that would have been great. It would be a great movie. But he didn't. He gills the lily. He goes overboard and loses it. And I really, you know, I really felt disappointed by that film. And I'll tell you another thing. On subsequent viewings, you know how sometimes you watch a movie again, you come back to the movie and you see things that you didn't see there before, and it kind of enhances your appreciation of the film. In the case of There Will Be Blood, subsequent viewings literally made me realize that I was even more right in disliking the film. It actually weakened the film. The film seemed even more half-assed than I initially gave it credit for. And it's sad because it's, you know, there's a lot of great things going for that film. Cinematography, yeah. Music, kind of the tone of it, the pace of it are all very solid, but it just loses it. I think he just crawls up his own ass so much that the movie just collapses.
I mean, he's still taking chances. That movie does, in structure, in some ways, it's similar to Apocalypse Now,
mm-hmm.
where you get to the end of this epic-feeling movie, and you know the director doesn't quite know how to end it, so they come up with a kind of left-field, more impressionistic ending.
Right.
And whereas in the case of Apocalypse Now, I feel it worked, and I don't think it did. I will say, though, that There Will Be Blood, in terms of Paul Thomas Anderson's career, I mean, like, a major turnaround from his reputation after Punch Drunk Love.
Well, absolutely.
I mean, if you think about...
Like, it was a good career move.
Well, yeah. If you think these days, especially post The Master, I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson has talked about almost of, like, Junior Kubrick level.
Absolutely.
Like,
very much so.
He's this great American filmmaker who goes and retreats, and nobody knows what he's doing, and then he just emerges with a masterpiece. I mean, that is not how he was thought of in 2003, where you were like, who's Thomas Anderson? It's like, oh, well, he's this really talented guy who made some movies I really liked, but his last movie was this borderline avant-garde Adam Sandler piece of shit that nobody liked.
Right,
so,
right.
Like, all of a sudden now, he's talking these revered terms, and right. it's...
Right. And I mean, and regardless of what I said about There Will Be Blood, it's a failure, but it's a noble failure. I mean,
it's not a failure
because he half-asses it. It's a failure because, you know, he loses it. There may be various reasons for why that got lost. You know, I personally really dislike Paul Dano in the movie. He was a replacement in that role. And I think it's absurd that he got cast in the first place because he does not hold the screen with Daniel Day-Lewis. And even though you could make a case that nobody could hold a screen with Daniel Day-Lewis in that film, I'm going to go and say that somebody could have held a screen with Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah.
And I think, like, Philip Seymour Hoffman, for example, could have held a screen with Daniel Day-Lewis in that movie.
Or Joaquin Phoenix.
Joaquin Phoenix, for that matter. Absolutely. Absolutely. And it just, you know, and with Paul Dano, I'm sorry, that just clearly did not work. And I there's so much I don't understand about that film. I could go on and on about it for an hour or so, but we don't have an hour. We got to get to their latest film, Steve, because Wes Anderson, fantastic Mr. Fox.
Wes Anderson did direct an animated film. A full-on, unapologetic children's film.
Sure.
I mean, if you watch that movie, it's a children's film for, like, smart 11-year-olds.
Right.
I tried to show that to my 3-year-old, and he checked out pretty quick.
Right.
It's interesting in that it talk about, forget about India, here's all the Wes Anderson rhythms and dialogue just transported into stop-motion animation.
Stop-motion talking animals. Yeah, and I really like Fantastic Mr. Fox. I'm with you. It's very watchable. Again, it's not, you know, there's really, you know, outside of Steve Zissou and even maybe including it, again, another perfectly fine Wes Anderson film that I enjoy. It feels like a Wes Anderson film. It has his, you know, obsessions and his rhythms. And it works, and I agree with you. And it does kind of make me feel like an 11-year-old, and it's, you know, it's a minor thing.
And I think it was a bit of a palate cleanser for him. This is just my own, you know, thoughts on the matter. But, you know, The Darjeeling Limited, which I feel is a pretty solid film, but as you say, the reception of that movie was just pretty much, well, here's another Wes Anderson film. If I like these types of movies, it's fine. And if I'm not that into it, there's no reason for me to go out and see it.
Right.
Like a solid album by a band where you already have their best album. So you're like, well, you know, like if I'm not a diehard, I don't know if I need to go. So it did. He took a step back because the Fantastic Mr. Fox, you know, obviously it's an adaptation. Also, from what I read, he more or less directed that film from a hotel room.
Yeah. What's the need to hang out in a stop-motion animation studio? Let's be honest.
Exactly.
That's a good way to develop a drinking problem, really.
Well, yeah. So it's kind of interesting. There Will Be Blood and The Darjeeling Limited were both in 2007. And then 5 years later, we get the next live-action movies from both of these.
That's right. And, you know, starting with Wes Anderson, the Moonrise Kingdom, it's funny you called The Fantastic Mr. Fox a palate cleanser. And it's because, you know, in many ways, Moonrise Kingdom is like the ultimate Wes Anderson movie because it literally revolves around children. It's got a huge cast of kids, you know. Probably has more kids' characters than it does adult characters.
I guess maybe a battery recharger.
That's it. Because, you know, because Moonrise Kingdom is like right in the box.
Oh, yeah.
Wes Anderson movie, smart alecky kids doing unkid-like things, talking in ways that real kids never actually talk in, doing things that real kids never actually do, falling in love. But the movie's fun. I mean, it's just very enjoyable. I really loved it, and it has just wonderful little performances in it. And again, it's a little movie, but it feels good, you know? I really enjoy it.
I have to say, as somebody who felt like The Darjeeling Limited was a little bit of an advance, at least a minor one, Moonrise Kingdom, therefore, feels like a little bit of a retreat. Like, under the blanket. You know, again, the sexual relations of the adults are once more
mocked.
Yes, and back into, like, well, I know adults do dirty things, but let's not get into that. There's also a scene in that movie that, there's a scene in that movie with the two leads on the beach where they're dancing in their underwear.
Uh-huh. It's a little creepy, right?
It's borderline illegal. I mean, it's I mean, if that wasn't it, you're like, oh, this is a serious movie by a real director, that's fine. If you just stumbled on that on the internet, I mean, some arrest might be made.
Yeah, he pushes that. And it is kind of interesting that he pushes that. But, you know, the movie's so innocent, and it has such an innocent vibe. That scene is uncomfortable, but it's uncomfortable. Like, its discomfort almost says more about the viewer than it says about the filmmaker.
Yeah. And Wes Anderson has also established himself at this point a little bit like Woody Allen, and certainly like the Coen brothers, where, you know, he has a rhythm to his dialogue and his pacing. And it's interesting to see how wide-ranging the different actors you can put into that.
Right.
I mean, it's partly his choice for casting, but there's never really been a bad Wes Anderson, a performance in the Wes Anderson.
No, not at all.
And in Moonrise Kingdom, we get a couple new bona fide movie stars playing that. We get Edward Norton and Bruce Willis.
Right.
And both of whom just slide in like a glove.
Very naturally. I'm going to go a step further, and I absolutely love Bruce Willis in this film. I think, you know, Bruce Willis got a lot of great reviews in Looper this year as well, and I really don't know what the big deal with him and Looper is. He's fine. It's just a solid Bruce Willis performance.
Sure.
But I love him in Moonrise Kingdom. He is heartbreaking. He really kind of, man, he's great. I you know, really watch him in that film. It's pretty stunning how solid, how good he is, and how he's able to be extremely still in a movie. And this sort of to me is a mark of an excellent film actor. Ability to sit there, stare, and not say anything, and not move.
I mean, the best thing I can say about him in that movie is that, you know, you can't credibly say you totally forget it's Bruce Willis.
No.
I mean, you just bought him as the character.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're just like, oh, that is that character.
Totally. And he's so pathetic in that movie, too. He's a you know, he plays like a small-town sheriff. He's incredibly pathetic. I've never really seen Bruce Willis be that pathetic in a film. And he's, you know, he pushes that. He goes in that direction in some of his performances. It's not like a new area for him, but I think nowhere nearly as successfully as he does in this film. Honestly.
But yeah, he's great. Edward Norton cracked me up with an over-the-top performance. And a great little Bill Murray, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Moonrise Kingdom is very good. The movie also looks cool. It has this sort of artificially... I'm not sure. I think it was shot digitally, but, I mean, they kind of make it look like...
Yeah, it's got a little bit of a 70s sheen to it.
Yeah.
It looks a little bit like...
It looks like
old
an aged
films
photograph.
You would watch in school, too.
Exactly. And it even has that aesthetic as a you know, as kind of a device that's sort of a like you're watching some educational movie from the early 70s, you know. Like, what, you know, what to expect from the opposite sex.
Exactly,
you know, that kind of
yeah.
stuff. And that's kind of fun. So, yeah, so a fine effort from Wes this year. And then, of course, that takes us to P.T. Anderson's latest, The Master. What'd you think of that, Steve?
Well, The Master, part of me feels like I'm still digesting The Master. I'll say this for The Master. The Master is way more focused than There Will Be Blood. I mean, The Master is almost claustrophobically focused.
Right.
I mean that in a good way.
Uh-huh, yes.
It does continue with every Paul Thomas Anderson movie, like literally every one, is about a male protagonist whose biological family is either disappointed him or is not a factor, and who is therefore looking for an alternative family. And this continues with The Master, which is, of course, about Joaquin Phoenix's character, who's a soldier post-World War II. And this guy's pretty fucked up.
Oh, yeah, this guy's crazy, like completely out of his mind, hardcore alcoholic, like the kind of alcoholic we don't see a lot these days, the kind of guy who actually likes drinking just about anything, you know. He'd rather drink some radiator fluid than he would have a beer, you know. That would be more up his alley. It's quite a performance, Steve, huh?
Joaquin Phoenix is fairly mesmerizing in this movie. He's such a volatile character, but yeah, you can't take your eyes off him.
Yeah, I agree. It's a unique character. I mean, it's such an out there character, such a wacky character, and at the same time, I encountered people like that. And I'm amazed that you don't see more of these kind of characters in films because, you know, if done right, this is amazing. I mean, this was a stunning performance. And first of all, it was the best Joaquin Phoenix performance I've ever seen. And he's kind of a fine actor. And he certainly needed a bit of a palate cleanse after his recent shenanigans,
yes.
You know, where he basically tried to pull some kind of a practical joke on the American viewing public by, you know, acting all crazy on talk shows and filming it as some kind of avant-garde documentary. That was not successful in any way, shape, or form and almost destroyed his career. And it's good to see him coming back with a performance of that level. He's amazing.
I mean, I think, to me, the answer of why you don't see more, sometimes you see these characters, but what the Master does, which is bold, is that you take this recognizable character and you make him the protagonist.
Yes.
I mean, one of the things I said after I watched it is, you know, if you imagine Mean Streets, I mean, imagine if Robert De Niro's Johnny Boy was the hero of the movie, not sidekick.
Right, right.
So that's one of the bold choices of the Master is it just erases the audience surrogate.
Right.
Like, that character is gone, and you are left to watch the world unfold through the eyes of this
extremely damaged individual.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you are with this guy. You are in his head so constantly. And this is, and here's where P.T. Anderson deserves an enormous amount of the credit by, you know, just instantly putting you into this guy's world and keeping you in that world. The movie is almost relentless in being in this man's head. And, you know, this is the last place most people would want to be, is in the head of that character. But there you are for 2.5 hours, and it is, it's hypnotic, I think. You know, I didn't quite ask you whether you liked The Master, but and that's a tough one because it's a tough nut to crack.
Yeah,
you know, it's
it is.
One of those things, like, I don't know what there is to like about it. It's not funny. It's not, you know, the drama is kind of weird in it because it's, you know, it's not, there's not really a plot, you know. The movie just kind of goes and it explores this character to such an incredible extent that you're kind of exhausted by the end of it. After a while, you kind of want to, you just want it to let you out of his head. You want to escape, get back into your own head. But I gotta say, I really liked it and I really appreciate it. I think it's a much stronger film than There Will Be Blood, and I think it's, like you said, it's a much more focused film than There Will Be Blood. I think it's really quite a brilliant movie.
Yeah, and the leads are all once again just pretty amazing. You know, and Philip Seymour Hoffman, there's an argument made that the movie is, there's a lot of similarities between the two characters that, you know, that,
well, sure,
Philip Seymour Hoffman's the ego and Joaquin Phoenix, of course, is the id.
Right.
But, you know, the one way to look at the movie is it's a bit of a love story between these two men,
sure,
in a way. And that they're drawn to each other and then they ultimately realize that, you know, they can't be together. There's still this, like, wellspring of affection.
Right, it's like Casablanca, but not in a gay way, you know what I'm saying? It's,
yeah,
it's not a sexual thing between these two guys. It's an intellectual connection. They are flip sides of the same coin, in a sense. And that, you know, that's handled very, very well. And the movie is long, but it didn't feel too long to me. It doesn't feel too short. Again, it's beautifully shot.
Yeah, and Amy Adams also is great. I mean,
yeah.
I'm a big Amy Adams fan in general.
Well, she can do no wrong.
Yeah, well, she's just really great because she can play kind of light and sweet, but then she's capable of so much more.
Yeah.
And in this movie, she does both.
Right.
I mean, she really just gradually reveals, like, the steely core of her character.
Right, right, right.
And,
right.
You know, there's this amazing scene in the bathroom between her and Philip Seymour Hoffman where she's basically saying, you know, we've got this thing going, and if you go out and sleep around on me, you can do whatever the hell you want as long as I never find out about it. No one we know ever finds out about it.
Uh-huh.
And that also kind of, you know, in the scene, she jerks him off and is more or less like just, you know, it's a woman calling into question when men chase tail and
right,
being like, look, we have things that are going on that are more important than your need to get your rocks off.
Right, right, right.
So always remember that getting your rocks off is like totally below this other shit. And let me just show you how minimal that is.
Right, exactly. And,
no, it's a devastating little scene.
It is. It's really cool. And, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman plays this sort of a, well, he's kind of a standard character for L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology. In fact, when the film came out, you know, a lot was made about the fact that this is kind of a, in disguise, it's a story of Scientology.
Sure, that was the buzz about it forever, you know, that it was just referred to as the Scientology movie.
And I find that to be, like, the least interesting aspect of the film, yeah. Honestly. I think
it's a red herring.
It is. It's totally a red herring. It's not about that. It's not designed to be any kind of expose of Scientology. And, you know, as of watching the film, I actually found the Scientology aspect of the film to be kind of interesting. And I didn't find that the film was an anti-Scientology in any way, shape, or form. It wasn't trying to reveal the Scientology movement as a big fraud or some kind of a cult. It really kind of, it just took it as it would deal with any other religion or anything, any other philosophy or psychoanalysis. Basically, the movie is about a man who is, you know, deeply troubled, who wants to get better, who wants to improve, and he happens to stumble upon this guy who has all of these highfalutin theories about how a man like that could improve himself, and gets focused on this guy, and it becomes kind of a battle of will. Can he help this man? Is this man want to be helped? Is he beyond help? And all of these issues really are at the heart of The Master, and it's not so much about Scientology per se, but about a man's struggle with his base nature, and to what extent we are really capable of overcoming that. And in that regard, it, you know, the movie just works great. I really like it, and I kind of want to see it again.
Yeah, I mean, it presents the movement, the cause, as it's called in the film. Uh-huh. And Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, the Master, as he is addressed, you know, the movie presents him as fraudulent in the sense that, you know, one character even spells it out, that he's making it up as he goes along.
Right. His old son spells it out.
Yeah, and he clearly likes power.
Right.
And there's a little hint that he gets some monetary gain out of this as well.
Sure.
But he's presented more as, you know, like all of us, you know, there are people looking for answers about how to live. Mm-hmm. What does it all mean? And the Master raises his hand as saying he has answers.
Oh, yeah, I get it.
And, you know, and maybe originally he does have some answers, or at least some interesting thoughts about things.
Right.
And so he starts gathering people around him, and it seems, you know, he likes that. He likes the power. He likes being the Master. Mm-hmm. And so the fraudulent aspects are just, you know, one of the subplots or, you know, drivers of the story is that, you know, he had a book, which everybody lapped up. But it's like, all right, well, what's next? What's book two? And so he, you know, his old bullshit is starting to run on fumes. So if he wants to keep being the Master, he needs some new bullshit.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seems it's a little bit of bullshit. But I guess the question is, and this could apply to Scientology too, it's like, is it really destructive bullshit? That if people want to believe whatever they want to believe and right. It helps get them through the day, then, you know,
what's wrong
more
with
power
it?
To them.
Well,
yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, with Scientology, you know, and I don't have any of those snarky feelings about Scientology. I'm not a Scientologist, but I know a little bit about it. I've come in some contact with it, and it's basically a self-help cult. In other words, you can, you know, if you apply the principles of Scientology, you genuinely can improve your life, and lots of people do, but it'll cost you, you know, and that's, you know, and that's the criticism. Like, are you willing to pay to improve your life? And most people in Scientology are willing to pay. And the question is, why are we not willing to pay? Maybe there's something wrong with us for not being into Scientology. But that's a kind of a silly thing. But I have to say that what the movie says, and I would kind of agree with that, is that, you know, people can help themselves become better if they want to help themselves to become better. You have to want it. And if you want it, then a path to self-improvement could be achieved through Scientology, and it could be achieved through Christianity and Buddhism or whatever else you want to get involved with. It's really up to you. And the movie, you know, and it's not a very complex message, But it's a solid message, and it's an intellectually sound message, and the movie, I think, nails it. And the movie does, you know, stays very focused to that, you know, central theme, and therefore is successful in nailing it, and also is cinematically engaging enough. But I clearly understand why some people hate it.
Your main character is a pretty damaged individual who, at the end of the movie, is perhaps less damaged.
Right.
But not...
He's not cured.
Correct.
No, he's not cured. He's the same, you know, asshole he always was. And again, that's the central theme of the movie. But he is better, and you can certainly argue that the techniques the master uses on him did something to make him better. Yeah. You know, I don't think it's undeniable that there was an impact on this guy that the master had, regardless of the possibility that the master is a charlatan, which I guess everybody is at the end of the day.
So that kind of brings us up to date on our...
It sure does, Steve. It sure does.
The two Andersons.
The two Andersons. We were going to work in other Andersons into the podcast, but I'm glad we didn't.
I don't know. If you had to pick in our cinematic smackdown, do you have a favorite?
You know, it's a good question. Again, you know, I'm going to just come back to saying that I think Wes Anderson works in a very, very limited sandbox, and Paul Thomas is out there taking a lot of chances. So I will generally always go with somebody who is more broad in their sort of areas of interest, as opposed to somebody who just kind of comes back to the same, you know, to the same little square over and over again. So I'd probably go with Paul Thomas Anderson. But I think pound for pound, in terms of the enjoyment that I've gotten out of the individual films, I think I'd have to give it to Wes. I mean, Wes Anderson has delighted me more consistently than Paul Thomas. So, you know, it's a bit of a tie.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say that I pretty much completely agree with all of that. So I know it's not a very exciting ender, but yeah, it's I've gotten more personal enjoyment from the Wes Anderson movies. But Wes Anderson, more than the new Hal Ashby or the new Coen brothers, it seems like he's the new Woody Allen in a way that
really is.
You know, he's gonna make Wes Anderson style movies from now until the end of time,
until he's 80.
Some of them will be really good, and some of them will be not as good, but it's kind of hard to imagine him whipping out some total left field masterpiece. And like you said with Paul, the ceiling is higher, but so is the basement.
Yes, I'd like to see Wes Anderson direct the next James Bond movie.
Well, there.
How funny would that be?
The sad part is I can pretty much picture exactly what that would look like.
Bond will be played by Jason Schwartzman, of course. And,
yes, it'll be very deadpan. There'll be a lot of scenes where one character says something, and there's a swish pan to another character.
Right, and all the action will take place off screen. So it'll be like just like a lot of gambling, maybe a little seduction, but all of it handled in a snarky manner.
It would be funny, though.
Yes, indeed.
All right, well, that's Film Driven. I'm Steve Haskin.
I'm Andre Shane. Join us next time.
All right.
Let's go.